Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, so you sent in some really interesting stuff about poverty in American cities, and honestly, it can feel a bit overwhelming trying to sort through it all.
It really can. There's just so much data, so many perspectives.
Yeah, so our goal today is really to, cut through that noise. We want to pull out the key ideas and figure out what's actually going on and maybe what could actually help.
Exactly. And we're drawing heavily from this discussion from the Dole Institute of Politics. It featured Angela Rashidi from AEI and Jesus Harina from the Family Independence Initiative.
Right, so two really knowledgeable people, but maybe coming at it from slightly different angles.
Definitely. Different experiences, different focus areas, which makes for a richer conversation, I think.
And for everyone listening, especially if you're here with us in the Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena area, we like to think about how these big ideas connect locally. We want to make this relevant. We'll dig into how poverty is even defined in the U.S., look back a bit at how we've tried to tackle it, and explore what might actually move the needle, for folks in our own neighborhoods, both the big picture systems and the power right here in our community.
Sounds good. So,
Yeah.
where do we start? Definition seems key.
Yeah, I think so. Because the first thing that jumped out at me from that discussion was it's not just one simple definition of poverty, is it?
No, not at all. That's a crucial point right off the bat. You might hear the poverty line and think it's one number, but actually, we use a few different ways to measure it.
Okay.
There's the official poverty measure, that one's been around since, what, the 60s. It mainly looks at pre-tax cash income and adjusts for inflation over time. But, and this is a big but Angela Rashidi highlighted,
Yeah.
it doesn't count a lot of the major government benefits people might receive today, things like tax credits or food assistance.
Huh. Okay, that seems like a pretty big omission if you're trying to see if those programs are actually, helping people escape poverty.
Exactly. So that's where the supplemental poverty measure, the SPM, comes in. It's newer.
And that one does include those benefits.
It does. It adds in things like SNAP-P, housing subsidies, those refundable tax credits we hear about. And it also tries to adjust the poverty threshold itself based on like geographic differences in housing costs. So it tries to get closer to what it actually costs to live.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. So these two measures, they probably tell different stories then.
They really can. And Rashidi pointed out that the supplemental measure, the SPM, it actually shows a more positive trend in recent decades.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, it suggests a pretty significant reduction in poverty, especially child poverty, over the last, say, 50 or 60 years.
Wow. Okay, so that is an aha moment. What's driving that reduction according to the SPM?
Largely, it seems to be those refundable tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit, the EITC, and the Child Tax Credit plus Nutrition Assistance, so SNAP. These programs, when counted, seem to lift a lot of families above that poverty line.
So government programs are working, at least according to that measure.
According to the SPM, yes, they're having a demonstrable impact on reducing measured poverty.
Another thing that struck me was this idea that poverty isn't always a permanent state for most people who experience it.
Right. That's super important. Rashidi's work and others suggest that most people who are poor in any given year are not in like long-term chronic poverty.
Because it's more fluid, people moving in and out.
Yeah, exactly. The annual statistics often capture different families each year who are facing maybe a temporary job loss, a health crisis, something that pushes them below the line for a while. It highlights income volatility as a really big issue.
Okay, so when we hear stats like, what is it, around 13% of the U.S. population, maybe 17% of kids are in poverty.
Roughly, yeah, depending on the measure and the year.
We need to remember that's a snapshot, and it might not be the same 13% year after year.
Precisely. And Rashidi also reminded us that these numbers usually come from big surveys like the Census Bureau CPS. They don't typically include everyone, like people in institutions or potentially some folks experiencing homelessness who are obviously facing severe hardship.
Right. Good caveats.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, when the news talks about the poverty line, they usually mean that older official measure, right?
Yeah.
The one based just on income.
That's generally the one they're referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah, the income-based one, which, as we said, misses a lot of the support systems. So understanding which measure is being used is pretty critical to interpreting the headlines.
Definitely. Okay, let's zoom out for a second. How does the U.S. stack up against other, wealthy Western countries on poverty?
Ah, the international comparison. It's complicated.
I bet.
When you look at absolute poverty measures, those try to set a baseline standard of living. accounting for cost differences, the U.S. actually doesn't look too bad compared to some European countries.
Really? So, like, the minimum standard here might be high.
In terms of sheer purchasing power for basic goods, potentially, yes. Someone officially poor in the U.S. might have access to more material goods than someone officially poor in, say, a less wealthy, developed nation.
Okay. But that's not the whole story, is it?
Not at all. Where the U.S. fares much worse is on relative poverty measures.
And relative poverty is?
It's measured based on income distribution within a country. Often it's defined as having income below, say, 50% or 60% of the national median income.
Ah, okay. And because the U.S. has such high income inequality.
Exactly. Our median income is high, but the gap between the middle and the bottom is really wide.
Mm.
So a lot more people fall below that 50% or 60% mark compared to countries with less inequality, even if their absolute standard of living isn't necessarily lower than in those other countries.
So it really highlights the inequality issue here. The gap is just so much bigger.
Precisely. Rashidi made that point, well, these relative measures are really measuring inequality as much as they are measuring absolute deprivation. It's a nuance that often gets lost.
Okay, that's a really helpful distinction. So poverty isn't simple to define or measure. Let's shift to how we've tried to address it. When you think anti-poverty efforts, I mean, LBJ's war on poverty usually comes to mind first, right?
It does. That's the classic starting point. But Angela Rashidi really emphasized that the late 1990s, specifically the welfare reform under Clinton, was arguably a more transformative period in recent history for anti-poverty policy.
Okay, more transformative than the war on poverty. How so?
Well, it fundamentally shifted the landscape for cash assistance. It replaced the old AFDC program with TNF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which put much stronger emphasis on work requirements and time limits for receiving cash aid.
Right, welfare to work push.
Exactly. And alongside that, another tool became much more prominent, the Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC.
Ah, yes, the EITC. We mentioned that earlier. Explain that a bit more.
Sure. Rashidi described it as a refundable tax credit specifically for low to moderate income working families, especially those with children. Refundable is key. It means if the credit is worth more than the taxes you owe, the government actually sends you the difference as a payment.
So it's basically a wage subsidy through the tax code.
Pretty much, yeah. And she pointed out it's now the largest cash or cash-like program supporting that group in the U.S.
And it seems like it's generally seen as pretty successful.
The evidence is quite strong, yes. Especially its expansion in the 90s, combined with welfare reform, is credited with significantly increasing employment rates, particularly among single mothers who hadn't been married.
Interesting. And did it reduce poverty, too?
Yes. Studies show it did lift a substantial number of children out of poverty, according to that official measure we talked about. It incentivized work and supplemented low wages.
Okay. Now, let's bring in the other perspective from that discussion, from Jesus Arena at the Family Independence Initiative. He seemed to offer a different lens, focusing less on government programs and more on, well, communities and individuals themselves.
Yeah, Harina's perspective is really valuable. He starts from the premise that experiencing financial poverty doesn't mean someone lacks resources in other parts of their life.
What kind of resources?
Things like strong social connections, community networks, skills, ingenuity. He calls it a strength-based approach, recognizing the assets people do have rather than just focusing on the deficit, which is, you know, lack of money.
That feels like a really important shift in thinking, not just seeing people as needy, but as having inherent capabilities.
Exactly. And he also pointed out something pretty critical about how current systems can sometimes backfire.
Backfire? How?
Well, this idea that as people work hard and start to earn a bit more money, they can hit these cliffs where they suddenly lose eligibility for essential benefits like child care subsidies or housing assistance or food stamps.
Ah, the benefit cliff we hear about.
Right. And sometimes the value of the lost benefit is actually more than the extra money they earned. So they work more, but end up financially worse off.
Wow, that creates a terrible disincentive to try and get ahead,
mm.
especially in that sort of middle ground income range, maybe 30K to 70K or 80K.
Precisely that range. It can trap people.
Yeah.
Harina shared a really personal story about his own mother.
Oh, yeah.
When she was on welfare years ago, she was apparently discouraged by the system from pursuing more education because it might have interfered with her benefits or work requirements. It's a stark example of how systems, even if well-intentioned, can sometimes hold people back from building long-term assets or skills.
That's powerful. Just a concrete example of a systemic problem.
Yeah.
So what's the alternative to these cliffs?
Well, one idea Harina touched on is designing benefits programs with smoother phase-outs, sometimes called graduated benefits. The idea is that as your income goes up, your benefits decrease slowly, gradually, so that you always come out ahead financially for every extra dollar you earn.
Makes sense. Work should always pay more. Is our system set up like that now?
It has elements of it, but it's often not coordinated well across different programs, and the phase-out rates can still be really steep in some cases. It's not optimally designed to avoid those work disincentives right now.
Okay, so there's this tension then between these big, often federally run programs and maybe more localized community-based approaches.
Definitely. Angela Rashidi spoke to this. She noted that federal programs, because they're governed by legislation and need national accountability for taxpayer money, often end up being somewhat rigid, maybe a one-size-fits-all approach.
Right. Hard to tailor a single federal program to the specific needs of, say, downtown Houston versus rural East Texas, or even Deer Park versus Pasadena.
Exactly. It makes local flexibility really challenging within those federal frameworks.
So what's the strength of the local approach then?
That's where community organizations shine, according to both speakers, really. Because they're embedded in the community, they often have a much better pulse on the actual specific needs of families and households. They can be more nimble, more tailored.
So ideally, you'd want strong local organizations with the resources and flexibility to act.
Rashidi suggested something like that well-resourced local groups may be funded through a mix of sources, not just government grants, giving them that independence and adaptability.
But Jesus Harina also expressed some frustration with the federal systems, didn't he?
He did. He voiced a feeling that the federal approach often doesn't fully value or even recognize the inherent abilities and strengths within under-resourced communities themselves.
Like that strength-based idea again?
Right. He perceived a tendency in federal funding to invest in designing programs for people rather than investing in people directly and trusting their ability to solve their own problems or leverage their own networks.
That feels like a fundamental philosophical difference, program versus people.
It really does. He mentioned the Family Self-Sufficiency Program as an example, a federal housing program made to help people build savings. Good idea in theory.
No.
But he said it's often underutilized because the administrative hurdles, the requirements, are just too burdensome for many families already juggling so much. It shows a disconnect between policy design and on-the-ground reality.
Which brings us neatly to this whole idea of just giving people cash directly and the trust involved there. We know the EITC, which is kind of like cash, works pretty well.
Right. Angela Rashidi acknowledged that these kinds of cash-based supports are common internationally. But she did raise that common concern here in the U.S. context. If cash payments aren't tied to work, could they discourage people from seeking or keeping jobs?
A potential work disincentive. It always comes up.
It does. But Jesus Arena pushed back on that pretty strongly. He drew on his organization's direct experience, plus evidence from things like the Guaranteed Income Pilot in Stockton, California, and groups like Give Directly working abroad.
And what did that experience show?
Overwhelmingly, he said, when people get direct, unconditional cash, they use it responsibly. For basic needs, rent, food, utilities, car repairs to get to work, to handle crises that might otherwise spiral. Not on frivolous things, which is the common fear.
And that connects back to the point that most poverty is temporary, right? People are trying to get ahead.
Exactly. Harina argues that direct cash can provide the crucial stability and breathing room people need to actually act on their plans, to take that next step, whether it's fixing the car, getting training, or just managing until the next paycheck.
He told that really surprising story about Kansas City, didn't he? Comparing universal pre-K to the EITC.
Yeah, that was fascinating. Apparently, some research there suggested that expanding the EITC actually produced better educational outcomes for kids than investing the same amount in a universal pre-K program.
Wow, yeah. How could that be?
The hypothesis Harina mentioned was maybe it comes down to trusting parents. Giving them the cash resource allows them to decide how best to support their child's development. Maybe it is preschool, or maybe it's better nutrition or stable housing or reducing parental stress. It highlights that potential power of individual agency.
That really challenges the top-down approach, the idea that experts always know best how to allocate resources for specific outcomes.
It does. Now, of course, Angela Rashidi did bring up the counterpoint, the concept of moral hazard.
Right. The idea that a safety net might make people less cautious or less motivated.
Yeah, that providing unconditional support might inadvertently discourage work effort. It's a classic economic argument and a central tension in designing safety nets.
But Harina's experience seems to directly contradict that, suggesting people are motivated and do act responsibly when trusted with resources.
His experience, and that of many direct CAF proponents, points that way. They argue the potential negative work effects are often overstated compared to the positive impacts on stability and well-being.
The idea of a universal basic income, UBI, also popped up briefly. Rashidi seems skeptical.
She expressed concerns, yeah. Similar to the non-work-tied cash payments, potential work disincentives, the huge cost, and also whether the public would support such a large-scale program detached from employment, questioning the need for public confidence in anti-poverty spending.
So, lots of debate around direct cash, but some compelling arguments for trusting individuals more. Let's shift to the pandemic, COVID-19, huge economic disruption, massive government response.
Huge is right. A real shock to the system. And the policy response was unprecedented in scale: economic impact payments, stimulus checks, boosted unemployment benefits, expanded SNAP, the enhanced child tax credit payments.
And what was the impact on poverty rates during that initial phase?
Surprisingly, perhaps, poverty rates actually declined initially, especially when using that broader supplemental measure. All that federal cash flooding into households buffered the impact of job losses for many.
So the safety net, supercharged, actually worked to prevent a massive spike in poverty, at least at first.
It seems so. But then, as you know, many of those programs were temporary. They expired, some got reinstated partially, then expired again. So poverty rates started fluctuating more.
Right. Which raises the long-term questions. Rashidi touched on this.
Yeah, she questioned the sustainability of that level of spending long-term, and again, raised concerns about the potential impact on work incentives if such generous benefits, largely disconnected from work requirements, were to become permanent features of the safety net.
The ongoing balancing act.
Yeah.
But Harina saw the pandemic differently.
He framed it more as underscoring the value of direct investment. He said the pandemic actually led to increased support for organizations like his, Family Independence Initiative, because they could get cash out quickly to people who are falling through the cracks of the slower federal response in 2020.
So it proved the model, in a way.
He argued it did, and he also made a pointed comparison, noting that we often raise concerns about the cost and sustainability of safety net programs for low-income families, but perhaps don't apply the same level of scrutiny or concern when discussing, say, large tax cuts that primarily benefit corporations or the wealthy. He sees an inconsistency there.
That's a fair point to raise. So his core message through all this seems to be, what, invest in people?
Pretty much. Invest in people directly. Trust their abilities, recognize their existing strengths and community connections, and shift from solely focusing on deficits to supporting their capacity to build their own futures. He sees that as key to tackling not just poverty, but broader income inequality.
Okay, so if an organization like his is focused on strengths and trusting people, how do they measure success? How do they know when their help isn't needed anymore or if it's working?
That's a great question. Harina explained it's less about hitting some external benchmark, like reaching a certain income level, and more about supporting individuals to define and take steps towards their own goals.
So success looks different for everyone.
Exactly. Success might be someone using the funds to pay down high interest debt, which improves their credit score and opens up future opportunities. It might be someone going back to school part time. It might be starting a small side business.
Even if an outsider might think, shouldn't they use that money for rent right now?
Right. Their approach trusts that the individual knows best what step will make the biggest difference for them long term. It's about catalyzing progress towards their aspirations, not imposing external definitions of success. It reinforces that whole theme of agency and trust.
It really flips the script from a deficit-based model to an asset-based or strength-based one. Really interesting.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's try to wrap this up. We've covered a lot. The fact that defining poverty is tricky, with different measures telling different stories. We looked at how anti-poverty efforts evolved, especially that big shift in the 90s towards work requirements and the rise of the EITC.
Right, and that tension between the big federal, sometimes one-size-fits-all programs, and the need for more flexible, responsive, local approaches.
And then this really powerful thread about trust the potential seen in direct cash assistance, whether through the EITC or programs like Harina's, and the idea of investing in people's inherent strengths and community ties.
Yeah, that strength-based perspective feels key.
So for our listeners, particularly thinking about Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, how does all this connect back home? And maybe encourages us to look around our own community. Are there efforts already happening that reflect some of these ideas?
It's a good question to ask. Are local groups working with residents, supporting their goals, leveraging community strengths, or is it mostly top-down services?
And it leaves me with this final thought. Given what we heard about direct investment and trusting people's agency, what kind of innovative local initiatives could we explore right here in our part of Southeast Houston that could really empower residents and help build more financial stability from the ground up?
That's something to chew on. Maybe it involves supporting those hyperlocal networks Arena talked about, or finding ways to provide more flexible, direct support.
Definitely something to think about. And perhaps a reason to look into the local organizations doing good work in our area. You can often find links and info about groups serving our communities on local resource websites. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us today.
Thanks for the discussion.